remanentes de un doloroso genocidio que se prolonga hasta hoy. Manuel Arismendi, Hispan TV.
Aquí pensaban seguir ganando el 100% con casas de apartamentos y echar al pueblo a sufrir. Y seguir de modo cruel contra el pueblo conspirando para seguirlo explotando. Y en eso llegó Fidel y se acabó la diversión. Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la diversión. Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar.
El presidente cubano Miguel Díaz-Canel cumple el viernes su primer año de gestión al frente del gobierno de la isla caribeña, marcado por aciertos y dificultades.
Hace exactamente un año, esta imagen selló la histórica transición generacional del gobierno en Cuba. 12 meses después de su elección, el presidente Miguel Díaz-Canel ha establecido un nuevo estilo de gobierno en medio de una situación económica compleja debido a las sanciones más severas de los Estados Unidos, restricciones financieras y la crisis actual en Venezuela, el principal aliado de la nación caribeña.
Díaz-Canel asumió la revolución que le elevó, ¿no? Fidel a todos nosotros. Yo pienso que él, está trabajando según sus posibilidades, según los recursos que tenemos. Sabemos que somos un país bloqueado y yo pienso que por lo menos se ha visto trabajando positivamente en varios sectores.
Ahora creo que va en buen camino, ha querido con todas sus cosas poco a poco y ha querido mejorar el país. Ha querido sustituir exportaciones por las importaciones mismas de nosotros, ha querido realzar esto de poco a poco y ha sido un año bastante difícil, pero bueno, hasta ahora desde mi punto de vista como joven creo que va por buen camino.
Realmente lo considero exitoso, porque ha seguido la línea del comandante y de la revolución como tal.
Para este analista cubano, el mandatario ha enfrentado un año complejo debido al difícil contexto económico doméstico y el adverso panorama internacional marcado por la agresividad de Washington contra la isla. No obstante, el jefe de Estado ha liderado el país con varios aciertos.
En el plano político, los cambios han sido muchos. Hay una nueva constitución, hay una apertura del espacio público con la apertura de internet, en los datos móviles, con la insistencia del presidente en utilizar los mecanismos electrónicos para la gobernanza. Es decir, tenemos el país ha continuado cambiando y esos cambios han ido en la dirección, aunque quizás no suficientemente, pero en la dirección que ha cambiado la sociedad cubana.
Incrementar la eficiencia económica ha sido su prioridad en medio de un escenario tenso en que los envíos de petróleo desde Caracas han disminuido sustancialmente y las exportaciones no han alcanzado sus ingresos proyectados.
Los problemas están básicamente en que no se ha logrado articular todo lo que implica la reforma económica, todo lo que implica la actualización del modelo económico cubano. Eso todavía está pendiente. Y no ha avanzado con la celeridad que debió avanzar.
Potenciar sectores claves como el turismo, la biotecnología, energías renovables, infraestructura y servicios médicos son las prioridades económicas del gobierno de Miguel Díaz-Canel en los próximos años. Raimundo Urrechaga, Hispan TV.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Norma Martínez se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Just a real easy guy. tell a lie, but then one day eyes turn blue. What were we supposed to do? Yes, eyes turned blue. What were we supposed to do? When eyes turned blue.
Santa Cruz is famous. It is all over the place.
Hi, R. Duck here, reaching out to you, our friendly listeners of FRSC, the fine...
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
It has been a busy week with the Ross Camp situation, where the city has been doing its best to coax, hound, frighten, or otherwise depopulate the Ross campground area. And Ross residents there have been struggling, some of them, to address the issue in court, document what the authorities have been trying to do, appear in local court to oppose the finding of the local judge, Paul Burdick, that the camp is a public nuisance, and a lot of stuff is happening very quickly. And in fact, tomorrow on Friday at 9 o'clock in San Jose, there is the famous, to me it's famous, the first time I've been to such a hearing with respect to Santa Cruz, a famous hearing before a federal court on the temporary injunction, or temporary restraining order, which may become a temporary injunction, which the court granted in the middle of the Tuesday City Council meeting that was trying to immediately shut down the Ross camp. Quite a dramatic situation. Hearing tomorrow, either at the hearing itself or fairly soon thereafter, I would imagine, though I'm not a big expert on federal court timelines, the court will decide whether this needs a full evidentiary hearing and keeps the temporary restraining order in place. Perhaps turns it into a permanent injunction, though I think that probably would be, I think that's down the road a piece. That hearing happens a lot later. But this is a hearing actually to see, I guess, if the temporary restraining order is lifted. And I've received just recently a copy of the Memorandum of Points and Authorities, the lawsuit calling for a contempt finding against the city, after the city essentially, in the opinion of a lot of us, ignored the court order of the court, the federal court, and attempted to continue to press Ross residents to leave the camp. Although it did not do so with force, it was trying to encourage them to do so voluntarily by offering this sort of very limited in both time and facilities, benchlands, campground, actually located in the same place, although a fenced-in area this time, sort of like a fishbowl or a birdcage or a local zoo exhibit, right next to the county building and adjacent to the road, fairly close to the Ocean Water Street Road, which is where, in part, the Occupy camp happened that was in San Lorenzo Park in the fall of 2011. A lot of these issues are going to be presented tomorrow with witnesses in court, or at least arguments. I'm not sure how many witnesses the court will actually take. And it'll be happening over in San Jose. If you want to try to hustle over the hill, you'll be able to be there. It's open to the public. I'll be there, and so will the mayor. Mayor Watkins and I had a meeting slated. I think it's our fifth or sixth scheduled meeting that we've had to cancel, one side or the other, or chose to cancel. But I guess we can always chat in the rostrum of the courthouse, you know, if possible. Here is what the lawsuit that was filed in court today against the city by the Ross Camp plaintiffs, or the Ross Camp Homeless Union, on behalf of Desiree Quintero, Santos Mendez, Michael Sweat, Sonny Lopez, Gail Saldana, Crystal Olson, Vanessa Montoya, Juan Macedo, Mark Hennerbach, Shannon Bumuska, and all other similarly situated residents of the Ross homeless encampment located behind Ross at the Gateway Plaza in Santa Cruz, California, as well as Food Not Bombs, the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom Group, that's HUF. And the reason we're in this lawsuit is because we have what's called associational rights to organize folks out there. And if the camp is dispersed, it impacts our ability to provide services and advocacy for people there. And, of course, it also, more significantly, provides less opportunity for people to support themselves. It destroys the community there, which in the minds of many of us is why the city is doing this. It has nothing to do with a real public nuisance. They've had the option to go after this campground for months, but declined to do so. Now, suddenly, it's a great public nuisance. I mean, it is, in many respects, overcrowded. It certainly needs a lot of support, and it should be given that kind of focus by the city, which, of course, the city has refused to do while forcing people to go there, sending people there from other camps, threatening them with citations or confiscation of property, or just showing up in armed force and encouraging them, in quotes, to leave. But in any case, here is the application for the order to show cause of why defendant City of Santa Cruz should not be held in contempt of court for violating the federal temporary restraining order of April 23rd. And we're going to read some of this now. From the moment it was announced by the city attorney to the Santa Cruz City Council, defendant City of Santa Cruz has been defying this court's temporary restraining order of April 23, 2019, as set forth in detail in the declarations of plaintiffs Alicia Kuhl, Shannon Vudmaska, Keith McHenry, and by the declaration of Santa Cruz City Council member and Public Safety Committeeman Drew Glover, and the various exhibits that go with these declarations. After learning of the TRO, the council voted to continue, that's a temporary restraining order, the council voted to continue a program disguised as voluntary self-eviction of the homeless from Ross Camp, as detailed in the declarations that follow. The city apparently interprets the court's order to the city to be restrained, this is the court's order was this, to, quote, be restrained from taking any action whatsoever to remove persons, unquote, from the camp, to mean only forcibly move residents. So the city is acting in the following manner to trick, pressure, and intimidate the residents to move. The vote by city council taken after the federal court temporary restraining order was read to the council to continue seeking, quote, voluntary, unquote, removal of Ross Camp residents was a subterfuge to remove residents. Even after this court issued the TRO, the city of Santa Cruz failed to remove posted copies of State Court Judge Burdick's public nuisance declaration and order to close the camp in 48 hours. And we'll be talking a little bit more about this in a bit, but that was done after a hearing on Monday, where a number of us appeared in the packed courtroom. Judge Burdick paid very little attention to any of the evidence. We did not have, those of us who were trying to keep the camp open, access to the photographs and exhibits that the prosecution, that is to say the city, showed the judge as they were attempting to close the court as a public nuisance. And there's quite a lengthy discussion of this, which I've talked about, I think, to some extent in prior shows. But the city promised originally to work with camp residents in place to clean up the camp and to make whatever changes they felt were needed. And the city, instead of doing this, suddenly decreed a relocation procedure to send people to this temporary camp over in the benchlands, which actually doesn't look so bad. You know, it's a nice area, but it's only for 5 to 7 days, after which people would not be allowed to return, although they didn't tell you that until a day later on Tuesday, that's last Tuesday, when the city council voted there will be no return to Ross Camp. But, of course, we knew that was coming because two council members, Council Member Watkins, Mayor Watkins, actually, also a council member, and Vice Mayor Justin Cummings, also a council member, sponsored such a resolution and put it on the agenda as long ago as last week. Although apparently that was being cooked up before then as well, under this unusual agenda procedure being used by the mayor, which seems to fly in the face of prior council agenda procedures, where the agenda is made instead of being made on the Wednesday before the city council meeting, it's made on the Thursday before the Wednesday before the city council meeting, 2 weeks before the city council. In any case, continuing reading, since we don't get too lost in some of the flashbacks or switchbacks or whatever, I'll read again from this order, which was filed today with the federal court, suggesting why the city is in contempt of the court order, which essentially said, you are restrained from taking any action whatsoever to remove persons from the Ross camp. And here's what was said. This is what the city did to intimidate and pressure residents. As a condition of being allowed into the city's alternative benchlands campground, Ross Camp residents are being made to sign waivers stating they are leaving Ross Camp of their own volition. All day yesterday, Wednesday, April 24th, Assistant City Manager Susie O'Hara and City Homelessness Assistant Megan Bunch walked through Ross Camp, warning residents that they had only till 4 p.m. to leave the camp, as if Judge Burdick's order was still in place, which is that's what he did. He ordered people to leave by Wednesday at 4 o'clock. But on Tuesday, in the middle of the city council meeting, the federal court ruled in and said, no, Judge Burdick, you can't do that. We're putting your order on hold. Alicia Kuhl, Ross Camp liaison and president of the plaintiff Santa Cruz Homeless Union, sent an email on Wednesday to the city advising him that city officials were breaking the TRO directly and by subterfuge, these subterfuge so-called voluntary removals. The city attorney ignored the communication. Police have intensified their presence at the Ross camp in a show of force designed to intimidate the residents, and Police Chief Mills is making front page newspaper comments that are false and inflammatory, blaming the homeless for an increase in crime. The show of force by police are contributing to a climate of fear and public hostility, not only against the homeless. Comments sent to the Santa Cruz Sentinel are bordering on incitements to violence, including what could be regarded as a threat to Judge Edward C. Davila, that's the fellow who's viewing this case over in federal court, attached to this application. As we write this request, that threat is still on the Santa Cruz Sentinel website, and I'll read it because I'm the one who sent it to Anthony Prince for a few hours ago, and he put it into this document, and this is what was filed with the court, and what the judge will be considering tonight and tomorrow. As the declaration and exhibits attached here show, the city is once again doing an end run around the court, and it's causing great distress and irreparable harm. The city is trying to run everyone out of the camp using the sham of assisting so-called willing residents to leave. We plaintiffs urge this court to enforce the TRO by issuing an order to show cause why defendant City of Santa Cruz should not be held in contempt. And it's signed by Alicia Kuhl, who's the pro se plaintiff. And here's what I found on Discus in response to one of the articles that Jessica York put up about the closing of the Ross camp. Let's put it this way, the courts stopping the closing of the Ross camp, the federal court. The local court is in hand-in-glove collusion with the city on this. This is a fellow who calls himself Winter Archer, and he wrote, "The city may be prevented from acting, but there is nothing stopping the citizens from taking action against a clear and present danger. If the police object, quote them from the Maxine Waters playbook. Get out there, people, and let them know they are unwelcome. Set up teams to, quote, escort them as they venture around town looking for things to steal. Get pictures of those showing up at the camp to purchase drugs. Do what your pathetic politicians and police won't." Judicial system of the bums, by the bums, for the bums. That's how backwards our political system is. Actually, I tend to agree with that, but for different reasons. Some federal judge who hasn't even seen this camp and isn't affected by it somehow feels he has the God-given authority. It's actually given by the Constitution, and sometimes I agree with it. Often and usually I don't. To rule against a local judge who ordered the camp closed because our local fire chief said it was an unsafe fire hazard and a public nuisance. Of course, if Judge Burdick had ruled the other way, you would have heard this guy, who signs himself Burmph, and saying exactly the opposite and denouncing Burdick, is my suspicion. Too bad we don't get to decide who sleeps in this federal judge's backyard. And that's a frequent argument used, or actually, it's kind of a piece of invective thrown at those who support the rights of homeless people to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, as I have been doing for years, saying, oh, put them in your backyard, as though that's a nice solution for poverty in Santa Cruz. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's what it is. How many new homeless camps are we going to have? I think Alicia Kuhl should keep her head down if she knows any better. There's a lot of information being discovered about her past. Supplemental declaration of Alicia Kuhl in support of this request to require the city to answer in court why it isn't in contempt for going around and still pressuring people, encouraging people, trying to move people out of the Ross camp, and even though there's a TRO in place. On April 23rd, I was present at the meeting of the Santa Cruz City Council, where they were about to vote to permanently shut down Ross Camp, when the Santa Cruz City Attorney, Anthony Condotti, interrupted to announce that the TRO had been granted. Mr. Condotti read the order out loud, including the part that read, quote, "The city is restrained from taking any action whatsoever to remove Ross Camp residents." However, right after this announcement, the city council still voted 4-3 to continue efforts to get Ross Camp residents to, quote, voluntarily leave Ross Camp. It sounded to me like another way to remove the residents, and was worried that pressure would be put on the homeless to, quote, voluntarily leave as a way to get around the TRO. After Mr. Condotti's announcement, I immediately went to the camp to let the residents know of the order, and as I was there, I witnessed Megan Bunch, whose title is Santa Cruz Homeless Assistant, sitting at a table and signing up Ross Camp residents to receive vouchers, quote-unquote vouchers, to remove residents from the Ross Camp and place them in the temporary San Lorenzo Park Benchlands Camp, which the city announced is only going to be open for 5 to 7 days, then would be closed with nowhere for the homeless to go. I moved closer to the table and overheard Bunch tell residents who had come to the table that the camp was going to close in 48 hours and they had better sign up. At no time did Bunch tell people that leaving was voluntary. I told Megan that I had just come from City Council and that the temporary restraining order had been issued and that no one had to leave the camp, that 48 hours deadline that the local judge, Judge Paul Burdick, had set was no longer there because of the TRO from the federal court. Bunch insisted the TRO did not matter and that she could still sign people up if they could just leave as a, quote, voluntary basis. Shortly thereafter, I was approached by several people from the Ross camp that were highly concerned. They told me that the, quote, ladies from the city at the table had been telling them that if they aren't out by Wednesday at 4, they will be removed by force and possibly arrested. I continued to get reports the rest of the day into the evening from very upset and confused Ross Camp residents who told me that they had been told by Bunch and O'Hara, that's Susie O'Hara, assistant city manager, that the camp would be closed. 6. Late that night, I sent an urgent email to City Attorney Anthony Condotti advising him of the false information and threats being made by city employees and insisting that he issue an order halting this activity or that we would return to court. He did not respond. The email is attached here as Exhibit A. The next day, after the TRO was issued, which was yesterday, Wednesday, April 24th, I witnessed again Megan Bunch back at the table with Assistant City Manager Susan O'Hara sitting at a table with a clipboard doing the same thing, signing people up for vouchers to leave the camp that they would get later and still telling residents that the camp was going to close. I noticed that despite the court's TRO, the city had not taken down the previous order of Superior Court Judge Burdick declaring the camp a public nuisance and ordering its closing by 4 p.m. This is confirmed by a story in yesterday's Santa Cruz Sentinel. Attached here is Exhibit B. I also saw a sign that had been posted that read, "Due to a court order and additional threat and legal action, unfortunately, the city is unable to provide additional benchland vouchers at this time." I have attached a photograph of this notice to this declaration as Exhibit C. As I am the Ross Camp liaison, I am known by most people at the Ross Camp. I stood there. Residents came up to me and told me that the only reason anyone signed up to go to the benchlands at all is because they were in fear of being forced out from the camp in such a short time, forcing them back onto the streets and face imminent harm. Even though the TRO is in effect, stopping them from removing people from the camp, Megan Bunch and Susie O'Hara were still scaring people that the camp was going to close. They were also saying, just as it says in the notice, that it was because of the federal court that they could not be placed in the benchlands. 10. As a result, many residents became scared since they had nowhere to go and were being told by Bunch and O'Hara the camp was going to close that day. Yesterday, Wednesday, at 4 p.m., I tried to tell these residents the court had told the city not to close the camp, but they were scared of being arrested and they left, including a group that packed up and started walking toward Highway 9, a very dangerous place to be. On April 24th, and that would have been yesterday, Shannon Vidmuska, who is a plaintiff in this case, came running up to me at the Ross camp while I was standing near the table that Susie O'Hara and Megan Bunch had set up. Wes White, who is the president of the Salinas Homeless Union, was making a video of how the city was ignoring the TRO and scaring people. Shannon exclaimed that Megan and Susie had walked into the camp hours earlier and told everyone that they had to be out of the camp by today at 4 p.m. And then she also, Shannon, addresses, includes a declaration stating the same thing in more detail. A little while later, a man named Greg Perry told me the exact same thing. I then went to the benchlands encampment on 424 with Robert Norris, that's me, who is a plaintiff in this case as president of HUF, the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Well, co-founder, member, organizer, president. As I came to that camp, I was accosted by Salvation Army worker Lauren Dixon in order to leave her camp. This is the benchlands camp over in San Lorenzo Park. I introduced myself after she asked who I was, and I told her I was the Ross Camp Council liaison, and I was there to find out if people had actually voluntarily left the Ross Camp to come to the benchlands. She became openly hostile, again telling me to leave her camp. This is a camp run by the Salvation Army, by the way. When I told her that I had a right to talk to people, she proceeded to walk in front of us, trying to stop us while yelling and screaming. I told her I was there to let people know of the TRO for the Ross Camp, and they didn't have to leave yet, that nobody had told those who had come to the benchlands they would be closing in 5 to 7 days. I refused to leave, as I had every right to be there. Alicia continues to write, and she wrote to this for the court, a man I recognized from Ross Camp came up to me and asked, I asked him if he had been told that the benchlands were closing in only 5 to 7 days, and he said that he was not aware, no one had told him. I asked the Salvation Army, Lauren Dixon, why people weren't aware they had to leave in 5 to 7 days, and her response was, she told me that people aren't aware because they were mentally ill, quote-unquote. We finally left after Lauren Dixon called the police and also told security guards from First Alarm to make us leave. Before we were kicked out of the benchlands, I noticed two giant water tanks providing the benchland campers water. For the whole time I had been at the Ross camp, as Ross camp liaison, that is to say, she doesn't live at the Ross camp. She lives in her vehicle. For 4 months, I've asked for potable water for the Ross encampment, and the city has always refused. I've asked for potable water for the Ross camp more than a dozen times over a period of 4 months. That's drinkable water. Now they were using water available at the benchlands to get people out of Ross, when all this time they didn't care whether the people had water or not. These were two large sort of tanker sort of like gigantic water coolers at the benchlands, but apparently not available for the Ross camp. According to a story and came out in yet, well, there's more to this declaration, which Alicia Kuhl wrote, and I think I'm going to be posting this at some point online as well as elsewhere. But it will, of course, be hopefully persuasive to the judge. I think Davila, his name is. As well as the articles and pictures. There is a flyer, "The city is lying to you. You can continue to live at Ross Camp until the federal court rules otherwise." This is a flyer distributed by people I'm sympathetic with. "You will not be allowed in Ross Camp if you move out. The Benchlands Camp will be closed before the end of April, or by May 1st, actually, I think is their new date. The River Street Camp closes on July 1st. If you can get into it, that's the old 1220 River Street. There is no room at the other shelters, or there is certainly no guaranteed room. And hotel vouchers will only be good for a few nights and are being used to get you to leave the camp. Please provide drawings or written ideas on how to improve your living conditions. Ross Camp meeting Friday, April 26th. That's tomorrow at 4 o'clock. And I believe it's now going to be at 5 o'clock so that we can be a little later in the day. But I guess I'll try to get there at 4 because that's what this flyer says. That's going to be tomorrow, and it may be a celebration, a victory celebration, or it may be a planning decision to support people in what they want to do, because if the court lifts the restraining order and allows the city to proceed with its bogus dispersal of the camp, its cruel dispersal of the camp, you have to say, then people are going to obviously go somewhere else. They're going to stream into the neighborhoods. They're going to go into the Poganip. They're going to go down into the City Hall area. Not necessarily City Hall. That's probably less of a likely place, though it's happened in the past. Downtown, beaches, parks, you name it. It's a ridiculous move by the city council. And you would think the reason for what the reason for it is. And the only thing that I can really... Well, what I propose is one of the possibilities is this is simply an attempt to double down on the city manager and fundamentally Susie O'Hara and Tina Scholl's long-term theoretical kind of on the drawing board plan to provide emergency shelter and eventually not even housing, but shelter for homeless people that they've continued to propose and violate time after time. The most egregious examples I can think of are, first they had this ridiculously costly River Street campground that they're reopening with money that could be pumped into the broader homeless population, provide a lot more services, a lot more shelter, but they don't want to do it. Some of that is, we don't want homeless people in our town, and it's just going to make Santa Cruz an enabler, you know, enabling homeless people to survive. Well, you know, that's... quite a horrible thing in the eyes of those where homeless people are blocking their view of the ocean and make them nervous when they're walking their dogs. I mean, it's true. But, of course, absurd. And something we have to fight. I'm going to be playing bits of audio from sort of the steps in the development of this. It is kind of a drama, but it's ridiculously unnecessary drama. As I said, the history of perfidy, misinformation, really lies if you're talking about the Susie O'Hara's claims of adequate shelter being predicted by certain dates. There was supposed to be a large navigation center or pre-navigation center opened up last summer. It wasn't, and instead they extended this costly and very limited 1220 River Street campground until August. And then they did it again, this time saying they would do it until April, the month we're in now, this year. But, of course, in October they abruptly cut it off, provided less winter shelter than the previous winter. The same kinds of promises now about there being adequate shelter when the Ross camp is dispersed, if they can get past the court's TRO, which is something we're going to see whether it happens tomorrow or not. If it does or even if it doesn't, we'll be out there. I guess 4 o'clock is something I'm saying now because I'm not sure whether the organizers of this, and I think some of it came from the sort of the Food Not Bombs area, but I think I'll see if I can get more accurate information on that. And I just found out it is 4 o'clock, or at least that's what the guy who wrote the flyer says. I think it was Keith McHenry. So show up at 4 tomorrow if you want to be a supporter for Ross Camp, get to meet the Ross Camp folks, celebrate what's going on, or plan for support to people if the police are coming in order to evict them from the area. Bring your cameras, bring your video, bring your phones, bring your friends. Let's begin with some audio from Sunday, April 21st. Again, at this point, the authorities have been posting notices that the camp was going to be relocated to the benchlands for cleaning. They didn't say that you wouldn't be able to come back. They didn't publicize the fact that the city council was going to be considering with a likely 4-vote slam dunk, which in fact they got, or they had in hand. It's not entirely clear because a lot of us were really trying to persuade Justin Cummings to change his mind. We had my first ever meeting with Cummings in a group setting with, you know, a significant amount of time spent talking to him about this issue. He continued to insist it was required to give homeless people services to eliminate Ross Camp, but the Ross Camp alarmed the neighbors, that the Ross Camp was... if you didn't believe what the city said about shelter, we could show how wrong the city was, and that would be a necessary price to pay for ousting 200 people. It was a ridiculous argument. I don't know how he could believe it had any credibility, but, you know, and everyone in the group that I was with where we talked about this disagreed with him, but he didn't seem to care. Or if he cared, he certainly didn't change his mind, as far as I know, in the final vote. Now, he became a little confused because on that Tuesday, which was 2 days after what you're about to hear, this Sunday audio, the city council vote was interrupted by the news that they couldn't shut the Ross Camp because it had been decided by the court that they had to wait until the hearing where the evidence would be considered, whether there it really was, whether it was an imminent threat, not a public nuisance, as was declared the day before on Monday and the day after this Sunday audio that you're about to hear, but the day before the city council meeting, Judge Burdick declared it was a public nuisance, as I said, in a very one-sided decision. But the question was whether, whatever the camp was, is there any alternative shelter of a real kind, or was it simply an attempt to eliminate the campground, kind of like in responding to mob feelings, such as the Depot Park gang that came and dumped the Depot Park proposal, which, limited as it was, might have provided, you know, dusk to dawn sleeping space for 50 people. Certainly wouldn't have dealt with the Ross Camp requirements, but it was a beginning. Even that was wrong. But that kind of, we don't want it here in our neighborhood, regardless of its actual impact and the actual threat, was ignored in terms of mythologies, smear tactics against the homeless, fears. And some of the arguments were legitimate, that there hadn't been a lot of public comment on it. But this is the same group that did not support keeping the Ross camp open. They don't want these homeless people anywhere. They want to build housing for them somewhere down the road, or let's have some indoor shelters a year from now, or something like that. The constant refrain of people who oppose any immediate addressing of the situation. Before I lose my way any further, let's listen to some voices from the Ross camp.
Oh, it's April 21st. I'm out here at the Ross camp about 1:30. Speaking with, if you wish to say.
My name is Sarah. I'm not going to say my last name.
No problem, Sarah. You say you attended the Homeless Lack of Services Center's meal on Thursday?
It was soup line. It was a soup line.
What was the soup? Did you pay your $1,000 to get in?
I did not. I volunteered.
And what did you? How many people showed up for this thing?
Slightly under 500, I think.
And of course, she's talking about a charity event to raise money for the Homeless Lack of Services Center for more lack of services to the homeless.
But it was quite a bit of people, yeah.
Any homeless people?
Not that I knew of. I didn't see anyone that I recognized.
Well, why should the Homeless Service Center concern itself with homeless people? I mean, you know, let's be real here.
This was definitely an event meant for donors. It was geared towards that. There were a lot of people that did donate, like, a lot of money, and some people had, like, assigned tables if they were big donors. Santa Cruz County Bank was there. The jury room was there.
Did they serve liquor?
They did not. Actually, they had wine there, but you had to pay $10 to get it. I didn't feel like getting $10 wine. But the best part is that we were keeping track of how many people were coming to the event. There was someone with a clicker making, you know, those things where you count how many people come in.
I do.
And if it got to 500, someone was going to have to be alerted that there wouldn't be enough soup for people if there were more than 500 people. So I said, so you're telling me that there are limited soup resources in the county, and some people are just going to have to go without.
Well, if the homeless have to go without, then so do the house. Hi, Cracky.
I almost went without soup. I came at the very last minute, and there was almost not soup left.
How was the soup?
It was pretty good.
Who provided it?
Several different restaurants. I know Eric's Deli did. Let's see. It was a lot of restaurants, but honestly, I just looked at the kind of soup. I didn't really pay attention to.
And hopefully no homeless people were served.
I don't think that there were any at the event. Drew was at the event. Huh? He was a celebrity ladler.
What does that mean?
There were celebrity ladlers that were like...
Oh, ladlers. Yeah, you said labelers.
Yeah. Andy Mills was there. He served soup, so that was like...
Didn't give out any tickets.
No, he did not give out any tickets.
No. Unlike his usual police force. That's how it goes sometimes. You
know? Yeah.
The guy just has to relax sometimes.
He does. He had
He's on the job most of the time.
Yeah, but this time he was strictly focused on soup serving. That was his goal for the evening.
Sounds super.
And it should be said that soup for homeless people, the general homeless population, ended in the summer of 2015. In fact, prompted the Freedom Sleepers to begin their sleepouts at City Hall, demanding an end to the sleeping ban. Initially, it was to protest the cutting off of services at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which had been growing increasingly and has been growing increasingly repressive and regimented over the years. Fences, ID checks, exclusionary policies, no parking nearby, sweeping the sidewalks in front of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, criminalizing or at least punishing people who sleep outside the Homeless Service Center because they have no place to go, so it's cutting them off from services. Bad stuff, but not unusual stuff for poverty pimps and people who are service providers who's suddenly developed more of an affection for getting government grants, expanding their operation, getting more community respectability. And it's kind of a sad commentary on the community that these kinds of tactics would get respectability. It gets respectability among a certain mentality in the community, the Take Back Santa Cruz mentality, the Santa Cruz Neighbors mentality, Santa Cruz Together mentality, that group of folks.
Was super.
Yes. Well, what else did you notice about the event that you think, if anything, deserves note?
Usually at these kinds of events, I've been to some like fundraising events and stuff. Usually there's quite a long program of, like stuff that's said about the organization or what they're doing. This is one where there was really not a lot of that. There was only two presentations, and they were both on success stories of the organization. So two separate people that had been housed through homeless services.
Did they present the budget and explain where all the money was going?
There was. That's the thing. That those are the only two things that were really. There was a presentation by the the board of directors person, the main person of
Phil Kramer.
Not Phil Kramer. It was. I don't remember her name. She's the head of the board of directors, though. So. And then Phil Kramer did a presentation, and then two staff members.
Keisha Schwartz.
That's the name, I think.
God help us. Well, sounds exciting. Anything? Yeah, and you weren't at this fine event.
No,
you can't win them all. You know? Maybe next year, get $500 a pittance. Anything else?
That's it. I just thought it was hilarious that there was actually a known number of if we run over this many people, there won't be enough soup for everybody. That cracks me up.
Will you be attending the next Huff Conscience in Action meeting?
If I can. Uh-huh. If I can.
Skipping town for a...
No.
Actually, Sarah made it.
Move someone in or do something.
Or move someone out. Evictions are all the rage.
Yes, that's true. I do a lot of that.
Well, again, we've been talking with
Sarah.
And occasionally with
Olivia.
Thank you both.
Of course.
All right. I was in front talking about. Talking with
Darius Mosanine.
Sorry, Darius, not Darius.
Well, I'll take either one. Darius sounds more formal. I kind of like it.
We have Darius the Great, and then we have Darius the Landlord. You got to watch out for that.
I'm also kind of a tenant now, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And let me tell you.
Well-to-do tenant.
That's a different story. That's a different... Let me tell you. There's... we'll save that for another time. But
yeah, but you're out here at the Ross Camp.
Okay, go ahead.
And you have some feelings that you would like... You wonder if the Ross Camp couldn't be put into some large tents and maneuvered like they did at the city after the earthquake when businesses were put in tents.
Exactly. And I think a lot of the problems... Okay, here's the three problems. If there might be more that us, quote, citizens have with the camp. A, the visual blight, which could be solved with those big dome tents. Two, the rampant drug use. I mean, the elephant's in the room, and 80-90% of the folks here are intravenous drug users or something else. We walked by and...
Get that figure from?
From the various...
Alicia Cube, perhaps?
I don't think it's TBSC. I think even...
Alicia Cube at TBSC is Take Back Santa Cruz co-founder.
Dr. Leff? I mean,
you never said that, but in
one of the many, many missives going around, and it seemed to come from a reliable source, but look, I mean, you have to agree, there is a majority of folks here that are drug users.
A significant number of people are using drugs here.
Okay.
And
so
I haven't checked on how many people in their houses are using drugs either, but I don't know what relevance that has to their being able to be allowed to sleep.
Because we look at it, it's like, if they don't care enough about themselves and their health, why should we?
And this, of course, is based on the presumption that drug addiction is a voluntary activity, which the courts haven't accepted since the mid-60s, but it's still a prevalent mythology and bigotry among people like Darius, and who represents a not inconsiderable minority of people in Santa Cruz. I'm not going to give you too much more of Darius, who actually was the only person who showed up at a forum last night, Wednesday night, with was intended to be a kind of a debate dialogue between people who have really great hostility toward the Ross Camp as a want to see it gone, and those who are supporters of the Ross Camp, a dialogue back and forth. This was organized by Wes White. I was critical about this whole idea because I felt we had to should be putting our energies into putting together the lawsuit for Friday, because at this point we've known for the last few days that Friday at 9:00 tomorrow is the time when we have to make the important arguments that the Ross Camp residents need to be protected, they need to be supported, not driven away, not as usual dispersed and thrown all over the city simply because of the latest bigotry and fears of various neighborhood groups. and the I got to say the gutless subservience of the city manager to this, although some of it I think is economically based. I think that there's just a general ideology that's been accepted, and it's not just succumbing to someone else's bigotry. It's sort of the native, we don't want poor people around here. It's just not, doesn't helpful, doesn't assist our tax base. We don't, you know, we want to keep growing into a wealthier, richer, more gentrified community. That's what the staff seems to have been doing for the last few years on a number of fronts, not just in its policies toward the homeless. Though I tend to be more of aware of those policies toward the homeless than on other fronts. But here's a little more of Darius before we pull the hook.
Answer that question
for
me.
You're not being asked to fund much of anything except to acknowledge.
Taxpayers, we are.
Not really. What kind of expenses are being used here? In terms of what would be happening around the city generally, in terms of police expenditures, be much more if this camp weren't here. It's ridiculous to make that kind of comparison. There is.
You have to admit, though, the problem. How do the majority of these folks end up here? Probably through a combination of
I don't know, and you don't know.
Well, I mean,
a variety of reasons. I'm sure.
We talked to a lot of the folks here that their drug use is definitely hampering.
All right, you're entitled to opinions, but opinions,
job,
as you know,
apartment.
Are like so, anal cavities.
I understand, but
we talked to a few. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll agree to disagree.
What did you find of the people you talked to? What percentage of those? Well, I mean, what did you find from the actual individuals you talked to?
You know, what was surprising. We talked to 3 or 4, and only one of them was from here. We Sacramento, Milwaukee, San Francisco, and the only one was local.
Was interesting. How recent?
Like a week. The one was here for a week from Sacramento. Mm-hmm. She heard that, was it Santa Cruz took up the sun? Milwaukee was, what is his reason? He came to Seattle. It was a prison, and he heard about Santa Cruz, came down here.
He's got a degree in IT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he has drugs and management. What do you call it?
He's got issues with being managed.
Rules.
Yeah,
rules.
And all this, of course, is, who knows? Maybe I do the same thing with my narrative, but he's fitting these. He seems to be, he has a prior narrative, it sounds like to me, that Santa Cruz is a magnet that affects these folks to come to Santa Cruz because they just want to be in this wonderful camp that's crowded, cramped, doesn't have any drinkable water, get to use a porta potty nearby. It's just a wonderful place to come. To me, that's complete bullshit. It is true that this is a zone of some privacy, relative privacy for people, because police may find it a little difficult engaging in the kind of constant fear that can be produced for people who are on the streets alone. There is a certain amount of more confidence in numbers. It's true. Narrative of you here at city councils. These are all out-of-towners. They aren't our local people, or they're a bunch of junkies and drug addicts that have come here. I spoke to that issue when I spoke to Darius about it. It has nothing to do with the rights of people to be able to sleep legally somewhere and their right to essentially to shelter themselves. Whatever they do with their bodies is their own real business. And this notion that you can then make them less than human beings because of addictions that people in houses can comfortably do because they have a nice private place and they paid some money to do it is, to me, a pretty disgusting and discriminatory and kind of blind analysis that so denies this of human beings and their value that it's a form of reductionism, really.
Telling them what to do. It's hard to take a job.
And this is the third stereotype. These are just people who can't follow rules. And they're rebels. And they're just, it's a problem. It's like these slaves. The slaves used to have an illness. I think it was called drapomania. This actually was proposed by a psychologist in the 1850s. They had this illness that made them run away from their slave owners. Amazing, isn't it? So, you hear where I stand a little bit more, and then we'll move on to something else.
You know, with that, but...
authority problem. And as we were talking to the other gal from Sacramento, there was the guy next to him blowing the glass pipe right in front of us there, and then there are needles everywhere. So, No, he was closed-toed shoes. But it does seem like heroin fantasy. It does seem like heroin fantasy camp in here. I mean...
And I've seen one needle in the camp, too, actually, in the course of the 4 or 5 months I've been there. And one of them was a guy sticking in his arm. That's true. And the other one was when we were cleaning up that stuff. But... and then I've seen a collection of needles that was gathered at a certain point. But the idea that you have to be very careful where you walk or something, I've been through the camp, I would almost say dozens of times, but not that many, 20 or 30 times maybe. And it's never been a problem. It's never been a visual problem, and it's never been a felt problem for me. Doesn't mean it isn't a concern in terms of, as such things are always concerns.
Yeah, depending on your preference.
Right.
But have you seen anybody been abusive to you as a consequence of using drugs here?
Not here, but what is the consequences to, you know, when they're high and they're in businesses and, you know, you hear the stories about, you know, the merchants here are suffering.
You hear about reefer madness stories, too. I'm sorry. You know, you gotta watch your step with the drug war talk.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is, if you have, you know, you have drug problems, you're going to have them everywhere. What this is a shelter area.
Right. In fact, I think they should turn lemons to lemonade here. They have this whole concentration of drug users, if you want to go on that narrative. Bring in the appropriate...
But I don't want to go on that narrative, so I'm going to move on. And actually what I may do is come back to this dialogue, because the debate between us continued, and it's a little tiring and a little repetitious for me. I mean, it's all too familiar, I guess, is what it is. But I've got other things I need to pass on to, so I will. But Sunday has a longer show, so maybe there'll be more opportunity there.
Bobby Dylan. The young Bobby Dylan. In a building of gold with riches untold lived the families in which the country was founded. And the merchants of Star with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded. And the noise outside was the ringing of revolution. Sadly they stared and sank in their chairs and searched for comforting notion. And the rich silver walls looked ready to fall as they shook in doubtful devotion. The ice cubes would clink as they freshened their drinks, wet their minds in bitter emotion. And they talked about the ringing of revolution. We were hardly aware of the hardships they bared for our times taken with treasure. Oh, life was a game and work was a shame, and pain was prevented by pleasure. The world, cold and gray, was so far away, in distance only money could measure. But their thoughts were broken by the ringing of revolution. And the clouds filled the room in darkening doom as the crooked smoke rings were rising. How long will it take? How can we escape? Someone asked, but no one's advising. and the quivering floor responds to the roar in a shape no longer surprises. As closer and closer comes the ringing of revolution. So softly they moan, please leave us alone, as back and forth they are pacing, and they cover their ears and try not to hear with pillows of silk they're embracing. The crackling crowd is laughing out loud, peeking in at the target they're chasing. Now trembling inside the ringing of revolution. With compromised sway, we gave it half away when we saw that rebellion was a-growing. Now everything's lost as they kneel by the cross where the blood Christ is still flowing. Too late for their sorrow, they've reached their tomorrow and reaped the seed they were sowing. Now harvested by the ringing of revolution. In tattered tuxedos, they face the new heroes and crawl about in confusion. And they sheepishly grin, for their memories were dim of the decade's dark execution. Hollow hands raised, they stood there amazed in the shattering of their illusion. As the windows were smashed by the ringing of revolution. Down on our knees, we're begging you, please, we're sorry for the way you were driven. There's no need to taunt, just take what you want, and we'll make amends if we're living. But away from the ground, the flames told the town that only the dead are forgiven. As they vanished inside the ringing of revolution.
Phil Oakes from the 60s song The Ringing of Revolution. And a goodie still, I think. So that conversation with Darius and others at the Ross camp was on Sunday. On Monday, we went to Judge Burdick's court because the city was trying to do an end run around the TRO, unsuccessfully, at least so far, by going into court to declare suddenly the camp was a public nuisance. And this was something that actually they didn't even need to go into court for, because the city manager had already declared it was a public nuisance and had to be cleaned up on, I guess, on Thursday or Friday. He was posting notices. And this court thing was sort of a secondary kick in the ass to homeless folks to get them out toward the benchlands and get them moving. They had to use the pretext that this was only a temporary relocation, because at that point there was still a city council resolution on the books that said there was going to be no final closing date of the Ross camp. But as I said before, Cummings and Watkins had come in with a resolution which we knew was going to be passed on Tuesday, and which in essence was passed kind of in violation of the court order, but it simply sort of postponed. It said the camp had to be closed. It was going to be closed, provided, this was the substance of the conversation at the city council meeting, once the TRO was overturned, as they expected it would be, or hoped it would be. The majority did anyway. This without any kind of guarantee of adequate shelter, which of course is the key issue in the reason that the plaintiffs sought the TRO. They weren't looking for wonderful accommodations. They weren't looking to prove that they have the right to live in a crowded, messy campground, and to some extent, because which is what it is. It's not that messy, but it's very crowded. They wanted to be able to be sure that they would simply not be moved away to nowhere unless there was adequate shelter somewhere else. And that is what the city did not want to face and still does not want to face. Anyway, in Burdick's court, there was a hearing held. They would not allow independent media to audio it, although the Sentinel was allowed free rein to run around, take photos, and so forth. When another photographer tried to take pictures, I think it was Lee Myers, he was escorted out of the room. They had four or five bailiffs in deputy outfits, wanding people at the door. McHenry was forced out of the room by bailiffs it's Keith McHenry of Funau Bombs, who claimed he was talking. I was sitting next to him. I didn't hear him talking. Maybe I was deaf or something. I don't think so. In some way that the bailiff didn't like. The court setting was very repressive, and Judge Burdick, who I've never really been a fan of. Of course, I'm not a fan of any of these judges. Burdick was the guy who dragged everybody in the Santa Cruz 11 case, some of us through a year, some of us through many years, of 3 or 4 years, even though the evidence of any kind of conspiracy, of any kind of even meaningful trespass or damage by any of the actual participants was generally not there. And this was a way to punish people who were political activists, many of them homeless civil rights activists. So I was no fan of Burdick's. Anyway, here's a discussion in the corridors where we took a brief break because the attorney Anthony Prince, who had taken over the case briefly as a special counsel only for the purposes of this hearing to defend the Ross Camp from the claim that it was a public nuisance and so shouldn't even be allowed to go any further. He found out, as I told you earlier, that the city attorney had not even given the defendants in this case, because it's kind of a confusing situation. Ross Camp people are defendants in this public nuisance case, but they're plaintiffs in their lawsuit against the city for trying to throw them out without adequate shelter. So it's a mixed bag. But in this particular courtroom, it's the defendants. Ross Camp is a defendant, and they should have been given the evidence about the public nuisance, and they weren't in terms of any of the exhibits until at the court itself, which was no time to consider it. And so Prince got 15 minutes to talk to his clients and look at the evidence. And this might have been even after the judge made his verdict. He declared he was going to rule against us from the very beginning, or that was his tendency, and he went right that way. But here's what we talked about in the hallway, or some of the stuff that happened in the court recess, brief recess before we got back and were told that it was a public nuisance and had to be eliminated within 48 hours by Wednesday at 4 o'clock. Which, of course, was lifted when the TRO was granted by the federal court the next day.
It's a break in the proceedings about 2:25 on April 22nd. We have a Bob, Drew Glover, one of his aides, Angel Lyon, Mike from the Java Johnson, a whole roster of city officials, York of the Sentinel, Sergio, Susie O'Hara, Mills of the Police Department, Fire Chief Haddock, Bernal, Tina Scholl, 4 million. Elise, Kevin, Ursula, a bunch of people I don't recognize, and four deputies or so. Burdick has called a 15-minute recess, finally giving a little something to Anthony Prince to give him a chance to consult with his clients based upon the agreement that the city attorney, Reed Galaglio, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing, had presented at the last minute but didn't present before the ex parte hearing. So there is
A lot of hubbub, as you can hear around me. We have one woman, Nina Stratton, kept requesting, and I think properly so, and I was pleased to hear it, that the attorneys and the judge speak up so people could hear it. And the judge made his ruling that essentially denied the request that Anthony Prince, the attorney in a special appearance for the plaintiffs here, wanted to have an actual hearing on the evidence, since the so-called evidence was not presented, just simply listed by the city attorney prior to this. He also asked, of course, for an additional amount of time, and the judge only gave him 48 hours. He repeatedly, Judge Burdick called it a catastrophe about to happen or some such thing, and that's kind of where we're at now.
Judge Burdick called the Ross Camp a catastrophe about to happen, to clarify.
Waiting for the final hammer to fall. What the latest word, of course, from the scuttlebutt is that there'll be that Anthony Prince or someone will take this issue. Maybe Alicia Cool, maybe some other plaintiffs will take the issue directly to federal court and try to get an injunction staying the move in the next 48 hours.
And that is exactly what happened. And indeed, that is exactly what the judge at the federal level did. For one of the first times in Santa Cruz history, there has been an effective, at least for the moment, challenging of city abuses.
So we'll see if that happens.
Go, man. Let's get all that stuff. Fuck you. Coffee on me. I'm all like...
What was his apartment?
He wanted cream for his coffee.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, a house for his coffee.
Yeah, a lot of people that live in houses are that way.
I know, it's a drag.
So there's a lot of rude house people.
I agree. A lot of people living in houses are very rude.
Yeah, the lady.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And this is a conversation between Keith McHenry, talking about people who live in houses being rude, as well as other people on occasion. And on my other side, these are sitting on opposite sides of me in the front row in the basement court, was Mike, who owns the Java Junction, who has had some stern things to say about the Ross encampment. He feels it's seriously cut into his business. He's angry that the Ross encampment is still there. And this is the dialogue between him and Keith McHenry.
Many people that live in houses break in and steal people's stuff. Yeah? Yeah? So that's what it... But the reality is that at a certain point, you're going to be lucky to have plumbing in your store.
So you... Everybody can live in the same area, right? I have family members who have to relocate, move to Reno.
Mike,
right?
Java Junction.
Or to go to... Or to kids are good to
but I'm just saying that once...
They can't stay here. My brother, my sister.
Yeah, but... You haven't been in refugee camps in Africa. Have you spent much time?
No.
Yeah, well, that's where we're going. Yeah, well, we're going that way, so you might want to go to Nairobi and to a refugee camp and see what it looks like, because that's what you'll be getting, whether you vote against the homeless or not.
Right, but we're not in session right now, and the minute we do, I'll turn it off. I'm just recording this conversation between these two gentlemen.
This is the bailiff trying to stop me from recording between two people in the break in the session, and she kept insisting I couldn't record inside, and I kept saying, sorry, the judge isn't here. And finally she said, okay, just make sure you turn it off. And I said, uh-huh. Although nobody made a record of this, except you had to buy an expensive transcript from the court. That's always seemed to me to be outrageous. And I personally favor people making their own recordings for their own personal use or to let others know about what's happening in the court. There's no reason, this is a public court, that these whole matters shouldn't be public.
Will do. Will do.
Yeah.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah. So that's the reality. I mean, so we're not preparing for there to be literally tens of thousands of people living outside in Santa Cruz. And many of them will be, I don't know, I mean, hopefully your mortgage is completely...
The city manager is leaving. Well, he's beating a retreat up the stairs with Susie O'Hara.
And there's a break here. The judge returned, gave his verdict, gave them 48 hours, which was overturned the next day by the federal courts. And then sometime later, 20 minutes later, we were in the hallway, and City Manager Martin Bernal and his entourage of the city attorney and the city attorney's assistant attorney, Susie O'Hare, and so forth, took off. And that's me referencing them in a critical manner.
And, of course, the police chief right behind. That's our compassionate police chief, right? That's the guy whose citations for being in parks has gone up. Up and up. And meanwhile, there are people still out in the corridor after this hearing. I better get my bag before it disappears. So, I'm talking with
Raphael.
And Raphael, you had a conference with Councilmember Vice Mayor Justin Cummings yesterday.
Yes, I did.
How long did you talk to him for?
About an hour.
And what struck you about that conversation?
He, I think, has a very reasonable opinion about the lack of coordination and planning that's gone and that's been involved in the way that the Ross camp is now being dispersed. And he agreed with me that the city needs to be doing more to provide in-city shelter spaces for people.
Did he indicate, because he is, of course, the person who is co-sponsoring this resolution, that there will be essentially an April 30th closing date with no requirement of there being alternate shelter space? Did you bring this to his attention, and did he in any way respond to that?
He stated that he's been operating with the advice of the city manager's office.
Oh, first mistake.
And when their advice is appears to be at odds with his own interpretations of the responsibilities of the city, that he might be making amendments to his proposal in order to meet the requirements of Martin v. Boise and also to ensure that there is a process by which the community would be involved in having their needs met when it comes to siting of a shelter space.
But in fact, the next day, when the issue came up, it was not at all clear to me that that's what Justin Cummings did. He eventually did vote in favor with the majority, the 4-3 liberal majority that sometimes comes together at council, to start re-exploring encampments, which had been put off the whole agenda by the 8th council member, Susie O'Hara. Of course, there isn't really an 8th council member. Susie O'Hara is a staff member, but she acts as though she is the 8th council member. The council consists of 7 people, and often people defer to her as though she's not just the 8th council member, but the mayor or the wise person who, you know, one has to respond to or follow the lead of. It's particularly disturbing because she has a very, very bad track record, but she's a very, very good at, she's a great wordsmith, and she uses phrases when asked about whether there'll be adequate shelter. Well, we expect that we will meet our goals. It's our firm intention that will be the case on the 30th. And right, there are all these many beds that she doesn't point out, that many of them are taken up with homeless people outside the Ross camp. And the ringing you heard in the background was a call, actually, from a person who's having police harassment problems, and he doesn't want to talk about it on the air or give his name, and perhaps I can learn more about it after this broadcast and, if he's willing, discuss it on Sunday. Back to the verdict, right after the verdict court verdict, there was essentially a rubber stamping of the city's position. No surprise. The city government's position.
Raphael, you are originally, I ran into you at a meeting some weeks ago. You're a part of the Friends of Depot Park, or in fact, you created the
That's your email signature.
Yes.
And originally, Depot Park friends were folks who were very angry and hostile, or at least very concerned, about Depot Park being just even a dusk to dawn sleeping spot for 50 homeless people.
Right, and our contention was that the city failed in its responsibility to have a collaborative, open process by which the community's needs could be heard and addressed prior to or as part of the process.
Public process. Now, what percentage of the group that came to City Council to really, on two occasions, very vocally, in some cases with some greatly clear negative stereotypes of homeless people, what percentage would favor a campground somewhere else in the city, as far as you can
see? I don't know the specific percentages of people that would favor one thing or another. I think that's we'd have the opportunity to poll people. I can tell you that there were over 1,500 people who signed the petition to pause the siting of the
How many of those are just NIMBYs nowhere, period, and how many of those actually believe in such a thing?
It's a good question, and you'd have to I'd have to review the data that I have.
I'm going to try to talk to you more when there's the attorney for the plaintiffs is meeting. I'm one of the plaintiffs, so I got to go meet with him. But thank you, and we've been talking with...
This is Raphael, and I'm the founder of Friends of Depot Park.
Thank you.
White, a video journalist who last night through this attempt to get Depot Park and other militant opponents of the Ross camp and other encampments to get together in a room and talk to supporters and have a dialogue. Actually, only two people showed up who were on that side. Everyone else was in favor of Ross camps. Seemed to me of a group of about 30 or 35 people in this big circle. Mark Premack, who writes regularly for the Sentinel, critical of rent control and I think other pro-homeless activity, though in the past he has been sort of seen in the vicinity of Paul Lee's proposals of actions in the Poganip. And then there was Darius, who you heard from her earlier in this recording. The Burdick hearing was Drew Glover, and here he is speaking afterward. He's a council member who's actually one of the only council members who's presenting a declaration in favor of the attempt to stop the city from closing Ross Camp and sue them for damages if they do. And here he is talking to the news media.
And what time is that council meeting tomorrow?
So that's the tricky part. So the council meeting is tomorrow in the afternoon, and the homelessness issue is the first one after the consent agenda. And that meeting for the afternoon starts at 11:30. So potentially around 12:30, which is difficult with regards to getting people there. Why is it so early in the day? So people from the community are going to have a harder time to get there, especially those with work and students. So there's a lot of problems with regards to the way the city's handling this and the way that they're moving forward legislatively.
Okay. Is there anything else about this issue that you'd like to add?
From the experience that we had at the camp yesterday, the people that live in the Ross camp are good people. They care about building strong community. They care about safety. They care about being able to support one another. And I think what is missing is the people that are housed that are speaking out against people experiencing homelessness from existing in Santa Cruz. Those people I found have not ever taken the opportunity to go out to the camp and physically engage with people and talk about their life experiences, talk about what it is that they've been generating, what they're doing, and what their hopes are. Because a lot of times when that happens and people actually take the step out of their comfort zone and go and actually meet with people face-to-face as humans, they come out of the other side of that interaction having a greater understanding of the situation, a greater understanding of the need to implement empathy and compassion along with constructive solutions around homelessness, and the human reality that we're facing right now and how a lot of these people have not chosen to be there. They're there as a result of our social and economic systems. They're there as a result of an emergency, and that everyone, or a study just came out where I think 40% of Americans just nationwide are one paycheck away from being in some kind of a financial emergency. So take that and cascade that across Santa Cruz. There's so many of us here in Santa Cruz that, especially with the cost of living here, we could be homeless tomorrow if something goes wrong. And this is the result, like I mentioned before, of poor legislation for decades in Santa Cruz. No affordable housing, no regulated housing markets. So we see skyrocketing rents, no living wage jobs, and it results in people living on the streets.
Kevin Roswell, R-O-T-H-W-E-L-L.
Perfect. And Kevin, tell me, you know, initial thoughts on what was...
This is Kevin, the supporter of Ross King.
Well, it's basically to continue depression of our poorest and our homeless community members by the city of Santa Cruz going back roughly four decades. The city wants its trajectory to be something along the lines of Seaside Palo Alto, you know, Stanford and by the sea, something along those lines. And that's pretty much the trajectory that it's been achieving, particularly since the Loma Prieta earthquake. It's been very successful in rebuilding a robust economy, something that, you know, was only a dream before the Loma Prieta earthquake. But with the University of California becoming much more of a science-oriented university rather than a pass-fail grade university, and the downtown community being much more receptive to the high-tech industry, particularly with Santa Cruz Fiber now being rolled out, which is a combined effort by the city of Santa Cruz and that opens the doors, of course, to the big tech firms coming over and displacing another wave of local Santa Cruz residents into the homeless community.
Meanwhile, over at Ross Camp, or actually a few minutes later, here's Attorney Anthony Prince talking to the community there.
The process of organizing, you'll find poor people. I mean, the poor, and especially the homeless, who are the most visible expression of poverty, are the most disorganized segment of society. And they mean to keep us this way because they fear what will happen the day the poor get organized. If you go back to the origins of this country, that was their fear from day one. The poor white indentured servants and the slaves would somehow get together. And the whole concept of racism was developed out of that fear. Am I right?
That's right. Making the
value. And I would like you to say what you just said on the loudspeaker, because then maybe...
There is one, but I don't know that... Let me finish my thought here, because my thought is that organizing is not just about getting with a loudspeaker and broadcasting a big message. Organizing at this stage is about identifying leaders and bringing consolidating those leaders into leadership bodies.
Yep.
That is it. It's more important than a loudspeaker. It's more important than getting out and having a big number. But most of the people in this camp are scared. They do not have anything on their minds primarily except survival. It doesn't mean that they're not ready to fight. They are. And they've indicated. And what we've done with this lawsuit in federal court, and what we did today, was we've taken some of the very best in this camp. We're ready to step up. That's what we've done in Salinas. That's what we've done in Marysville. That's what we've done in Yuba City. That's what we're doing here in Santa Cruz. That's what we're doing across the country. We have about 15 or 20 cities where we're organizing these homeless unions. Okay, we're getting ready to establish a national unit for homeless. Listen to me. Listen to me. This is not going to be easy. So the most important thing is we're going to lose most of these battles. We're going to lose the battles in court. We're going to lose the battles with the city administration. We're going to lose the battle for public opinion most of the time. But what we can do is we can continue to organize in a disciplined manner. The first step is to bring leaders together so those leaders can stick and stay. Okay, they're going to put up a new camp. That camp has to be organized by the homeless unit. It has to be organized by the leaders here.
Do you think they're going to let me in there?
So that as much as possible. What'd you say?
So do you think they're going to let me in there? That new camp?
They can't stop you from
I don't know.
there, and if they do it, we raise a constitutional challenge. See, the problem with this judge's decision today and all these decisions is that they're fencing out more people than they're fencing in. It's just like what happened with the fugitive slave period of history, where it's one thing to say, okay, well, you have the slave runs away, and the slave owner can take him back, and that's all there is to it. Then the next thing is, okay, well, not only that, but if you live in a free state, you have to help them bring that slave back to the plantation. And if you don't, you'll be arrested.
You can't write and you can't publish a paper.
So, the next thing was you can't publish a paper. I don't preach to the choir, but the choir needs to be organized. It's okay to preach to the choir. The choir needs to start coming together in a unified discipline.
And I think also because he's from somewhere else, so he's not here to continuously constitute this message over and over again, so it's on us as people that engage consistently with the camp to begin, as he mentioned, identifying people that are willing to step into those roles, like Alicia, like Crystal, and the other people that are named in the lawsuit. But the key is that we need to move as a unit, because we do a loudspeaker right now, yeah, a bunch of people come out, but then they'll go back, and so how do we engage them?
So I would say you've got to publish your flyers to inform everyone. Yeah, you got to do that. Sometimes you'll get a lot of people. Look at the homeless here in Salinas. Sometimes we call meetings, you get 50 people, 100 people, sometimes 4 people. But over the last 5 years, it's consistently continued to exist. Am I right?
Yeah.
Through thick and thin, big and small, big numbers, small,
and fall to face the earth.
And it's gotten to the point now where because we just stuck in there with the leadership, okay, that we're starting to have some real influence. And Wes is like the daddy. Him and Rita Acosta, him and Raylan Butcher and Brian, they're like the parents of more and more of these homeless units. We're just at the beginning of the process. I don't get discouraged, man, because I look at it from an historical lens. Okay? There was slavery in this country for 400 years, and then in a period of 40 or 50 years, national opinion changed because the slave was running away and had to change the whole conversation. And homeless people are standing up. This lawsuit in federal court, what we did just now today, is it can't see it immediately. You don't see the roots. You know, but the roots are what allows the plant to come up. We're digging for the roots now. I know this is discouraging. I know we're in these battles all the time. But you guys are toughing out a way of survival. It's all about survival. But survival in order to further organize. Okay? So what we need, the next step as far as I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going into federal court tomorrow. We're going to have a copy of this order that this judge just signed. I mean, can you imagine the utter contempt to take the fire chief's word and disregard the word of a sitting city council member? I mean, Drew had a declaration directly refuting what that fire chief said about conditions in this camp, and the court wouldn't even consider it. And we're going to tell the federal court about that tomorrow. It's completely inappropriate. We told them, you don't have to destroy the whole camp to deal with health and safety issues. Why do you have to destroy the whole camp?
Right.
People don't want to be in an unsafe circumstance. Okay, you can collaborate with people. They don't want this camp here. I'll tell you why. One of the reasons they don't want this camp here is this camp is getting organized. There's a Ross Camp Council. I swear, the minute they formed the Ross Camp Council, they said, And the same thing happened.
I thought I was leaving.
But you know what? Here's the problem. There's a problem with those guys. They're so short-sighted. So they break up this camp. Guess what? Another camp's going to form.
Exactly.
And this time, the leadership, step by step, becoming more experienced, becoming more consolidated, will exercise that same organization leadership in the next camp. They can't stop camps from forming.
No.
They chased everyone out of the river bottoms and the levees up there in 2016, the Hollywood camp. Brian filed his own individual lawsuit. Got a class action going there. We're coming right up. They can't stop us, okay?
Yeah.
You know what's happening now on the same river bottoms that they broke up in 2016? The camps are all the way back again. They're back again, man.
No way.
They cannot stop them. They cannot. The tent. See these tents? These tents frighten them. Because, you go back in history and you look at the runaway slaves, they'd set up tent cities. A lot of people don't know that. They took these tents. The Union Army would leave these tents behind. They called them the Sibley tents. And President Lincoln came out of the White House and he said, what's going on here? These tents. And he opened it up and here's these runaway slaves. And said, Mr. President, we're running away from slavery. We want to join the Union Army and fight. You know what I'm trying to say?
Right.
And it took 30 years before they finally got to the position that, okay, we have to let this happen. And then slavery was abolished, okay, because of the struggle that was put up by the people at the bottom. We're at the bottom here, man.
Right.
And so we have nothing to lose. What do they actually want? Let me ask you guys, what do they actually want? They have to put up another encampment now. Some people are going to be dispersed out. But let's stay in touch with them. Let's each one take care of everybody here. We take care of people as best we can in the union. We don't want anybody to die. We don't want women to come out here all by themselves being sexually assaulted. So let's take care of people. Let's have a network. You got an ally in city council. You know what that enables you to do? Drew can go in there and make official reports every meeting. He can create a paper trail and a record this thick. And that's going to be very important as we move forward in the litigation standpoint and in the world of public opinion. Now, they just shut down took out more benches on the bus stops, right? Who else gets the story I read in the paper when I was here a couple weeks ago was that there's a disabled guy. He's not a homeless, but he's disabled.
Right.
And he sat at that bus stop for 20 years because he has to have a place to sit down.
Yep.
That means we can reach out to the disability community. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yep.
With every step, what about the students? In Monterey County, we got 6,000 homeless students in Monterey County.
Right.
Let's
here
organize
we have Tomas
them.
With the snail movement.
What's that?
Tomas with the snail movement has organized a, it's called the snail movement because UCSC, the campus security and police have harassed, woken up their homeless students, demanded to know if they're students and scared the crap out of them. And so Tomas has Tedesco. He has started a movement there so that homeless students can sleep in their car. And he's actually made he's on a special list for his academics, even though he's sleeping in his vehicle and getting woken up at night.
Right. San Jose, if you go up to San Jose, we met with some people from San Jose the other day. They told us at San Jose State University there are 4,000 homeless students.
Wow.
4,000 homeless. We're going to organize all of them, or as many of the leaders as we can, into the homeless union. We're going to have homeless union locals all over the place. And then things are going to start to change, not all at once. So I know it's discouraging. This judge, you got those who are there at the hearing right now. You saw what I did, man. I'm relentless with it. I don't care. I'll lay it on the line. And the lawyer for the city came out, tried to shake my hand afterwards. I said, I'm not going to shake your hand, man. He said, well, this is a professional. He said, if you were a professional, you would have agreed with me that we need to postpone this to have a full-blown hearing so all the evidence could be put in front of the court.
Yeah.
It's not professional. It's a violation of your ethical obligation to fully inform the court. You're perpetrating a fraud on the court is what you did. I'm shaking your hand, man.
Yeah.
He's looking at me, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, because the fact of the matter is that this is a real fight, and I believe in this stuff. Since, you know, this isn't a game to me. This isn't I respect you. We're just neutral. I am no neutral. Everyone's one step away from this situation. Okay. Yeah,
I just wanted to hear more of this, and there is another 20 minutes of it, and it's eloquent talk by Anthony Prince, and he fields questions out at the Ross camp on Monday after the judge verdict ruled everybody has to be out in 48 hours, as I said, overturned the next day by the federal judge, and we'll see tomorrow what happens. It's a roller coaster. But go to the YouTube and then look for a Santa Cruz ex parte hearing to abate the Gateway encampment. Santa Cruz ex parte hearing to abate the Gateway encampment. Could be if you just look up Gateway encampment, you'll find it. Or you can also look for John and then the word Joe 13K. Those two words, Joe or John and then Doe 13K. Give you a variety of Wes White's videos, the most recent one being the Santa Cruz ex parte hearing to abate the Gateway encampment. Actually, maybe some even more recent ones.
In many a time, in many a land, with many a gun, in many a hand, they came by the night, they came by the day, came with their guns to take us away. With a knock on the door, knock on the door, here they come to take one more, one more. Back in the days of the Roman Empire, they died by the cross and they died by the fire. In the stone Colosseum, the crowd gave a roar, and it all began with that knock on the door. Just a knock on the door, knock on the door, here they come to take one more, one more. The years have all passed, we've reached modern times, The Nazis have come with their Nazi war crimes. Yes, the power was there, the power was found. 6 million people have heard that same sound, that old knock on the door, knock on the door. Here they come to take one more, one more. Now there's many new words and many new names. The banners have changed, but the knock is the same. On the Soviet shores, with right on their side, I wonder who knows how many have died. We're there, knock on the door, knock on the door. Here they come to take one more, one more. Look over the oceans, look over the lands, look over the leaders with the blood on their hands. And open your eyes and see what they do. When they knock over their friend, they're knocking for you. With their knock on the door, knock on the door. Here they come to take one more. With their knock on the door, knock on the door. Here they come to take one more, one more.
That, of course, was Phil Oakes. Knock on the door. I'm running a little short on time. This is the short show. I do 2 hours on Thursday. And I don't know if I'm going to have the will, the motivation, or the interest to do this on Sunday, but I may come back, and you, of course, can, you listeners, can go to the city's website, City of Santa Cruz, and you can hear Tuesday's debate, discussion, city council meeting. A lot of interesting points. Drew Glover was rather eloquent, as often he is. Justin Cummings was disappointing generally, although there were a few minor twists and turns. I spoke in the morning of Tuesday at what's called the closed session, where for the first time, and the city has kind of made it a point not to pay much attention to this Ross Camp lawsuit by the people out there until such time as they had to, later in the day when the court came through with its ruling, hold it, you can't remove people from the Ross Camp anymore, at least not until you come to court and justify yourselves, which is going to happen tomorrow. I was speaking on behalf of the, well, not on behalf of the plaintiffs, but in favor of them. I am one of the plaintiffs, so I guess you can say I'm certainly giving the perspective, at least my side of the, my viewpoint on this. And I wrote a speech which I wasn't able to give fully because I was only given, I was initially given 2 minutes. I asked for 3 minutes. The mayor didn't want to do it, but Drew Glover made a motion. I believe it was Drew who made the motion, and I got actually surprisingly support from Justin Cummings. Of course, I pointed out I was the only speaker, and this was at 10 o'clock in the morning. The room was full of police officers who were apparently there to get a better contract, which was also being discussed in the closed session that was to follow a very brief open interval where the public can speak, but they cannot hear what is then subsequently said because it's all closed, you know, litigation matters and personnel matters. You know, it's something I've always sort of accepted. Oh, yeah, well, that, you don't get to look at that. But, I find myself thinking that doesn't sound as right to me as it used to. Anyway, my speech went like this. It was entitled Save Money, Save Lives, Settle the Quintero Lawsuit. And Desiree Quintero is one of the, I think, 9 or 10 Ross Camp residents who are suing to keep their tents, to keep their place, to keep their right to survive there until that they and the rest of the camp can get alternate shelter. Today you'll be reviewing action on the Desiree Quintero lawsuit, or the Ross Camp plaintiff's lawsuit. Its aim is to prevent the harm that would come from closing the Ross Camp without adequate indoor shelter alternatives, which you do not have. Not even the pretense of outdoor shelter alternatives. Your city attorney's standard operating procedures, which will be what's used to remove the camp, don't meet constitutional muster and abusively require evictions without alternate shelter. Yesterday's back-scratching decision, that was Burdick's decision, Judge Burdick, declaring the Ross Camp a public nuisance, authorizes police force against the homeless tomorrow at 4 p.m. It was done without evidence other than assertions by partisan city officials beholden to the city manager for their positions. It will be challenged this morning in federal court in San Jose. You have a chance to backtrack on this bad situation, both in closed session now and in open session on item 13 later today. They didn't, of course. In fact, they were almost openly... They didn't really conceal their contempt for the court decision or their regret, certainly at the very least. Instead of wasting city money on going to court, begin negotiations with the Ross Camp plaintiffs. Work out reasonable arrangements for a cleanup involving the camp residents in place instead of forcing a difficult relocation. Abandon the charade of the San Lorenzo benchlands as a campground. It hasn't been authorized with any public notice or input. It violates your own prior city council resolutions. It's just simply a dictate by the city manager, who just decided he could do whatever he wanted. Acknowledge honestly that you don't even have alternate outdoor alternatives now, with the Depot Park proposal gone, which you scampered away from at the last city council meeting. Don't use the homeless as an experiment to see how efficient or accountable the staff is. And that, of course, was what Justin Cummings said he wanted to do, or thought was a good idea, or he thought was a selling point for liberals, because we want to find the staff and make them accountable. The idea that that's somehow more important than the lives and the property of the homeless people that would be threatened. Well, I've already commented on how ridiculous that is. Re-examine the fanciful shelter narratives by O'Hara and Shull, two city managers, before they are deconstructed publicly in court, which is going to happen tomorrow. Even if their thrice-told tales were true, sheltering Ross would displace the large homeless population, the larger homeless population outside Ross, as tickets for trespass, being in a closed area, and public nuisance rise. These tickets being slippery alternatives to camping ban tickets, which you can use, which the city has been using in order to avoid the court's Martin versus Boise protection of the homeless, but you will still be held to account in court. Forestall injuries in health and safety to the elderly, the sick, and children in these groups. These are now more likely than ever to be documented and made a part of this lawsuit, which will proceed for damages, even if the camp is leveled. Ask yourselves, do you really want a flood of people pouring into neighborhoods, downtown business doorways, beaches and parks? I don't think they care, but services can be provided at Ross Camp, where there's a large concentration of folks, if you have the will to do so. Instead, folks will now be sleeping, pissing, crapping, and dying all over town. One can't even calculate the increased police expense and subsequent court costs as the California Homeless Union educates the homeless on taking you to federal court. Reconsider, rethink, don't double down on the staff's bad shelter estimates and the city attorney's sunny reading of the ability to slip past the Martin versus Boise decision. And that's kind of my somewhat elaborated reading of this speech that I gave at City Council, or part of which I gave at City Council. So I'm impressed with some of the folks who came out to, well, perhaps it's to do penance for their past crimes, errors, abuses against the homeless. I'm thinking particularly of my friend Micah Posner, who was involved in a number of anti-homeless votes on City Council, and more important, I think, failures to use the position he had to make a stronger standing in a way, for example, that Drew is doing, although Drew has the advantage of two allies and one strong, fairly strong ally, surprisingly, Chris Krohn. But Micah Posner was, several months ago, helping to put together a list of laws that need to be re-examined, and we put those together with the help of Drew Glover's interns, and they were sent to the city staff for a return on the next city council agenda, which will be, I think it's the second Tuesday in May. It's not going to be next Tuesday or the Tuesday after, but the Tuesday after that. It's kind of a almost 3 weeks away now. Spent some time working on that. And I also he also contacted me today offering to do a declaration for the lawsuit, which he did. It wasn't necessarily that helpful, according to Anthony, the Prince, the attorney, but I like the substance of it, and I'm going to read it. It reads as follows. I am Micah Posner. I know the following of my own personal knowledge, and if called to testify, would testify to the same. I was elected to serve on the City Council of the City of Santa Cruz between 2012 and 2016. In my term, the city did not seriously attempt to provide shelter options for people without homes. To the contrary, the attitude of the city, as publicly expressed numerous times by its chief administrative officer, City Manager Martine Bernal, was that the county, as the jurisdiction in charge of health and welfare, was responsible for the welfare of the homeless and not the city. His opinion was reiterated publicly and repeatedly by the majority of the council with whom I served. Mr. Bernal continues to serve as the city manager. Current council member Cynthia Matthews, with whom I served, also publicly stated this opinion. During my term, the city concurrently did everything it could to criminalize the homeless for sleeping within the city limits. This involved giving tickets to people without homes and otherwise harassing them. At the beginning of my term, these tickets were generally for camping, and the city was in an ongoing conflict with the court system who were disinclined to issue warrants for people who did not address camping tickets. The city eventually won the permission for the city attorney to persecute and obtain warrants for people without homes who did not address three camping tickets. The police chief at the time, Kevin Vogel, was and continues to be, as a private citizen, a clear proponent for the camping ban. During my term on council, the legal right of jurisdictions to criminalize sleeping was coming into question. The opinion of the Obama administration's Justice Department and the emerging case law, including preliminary decisions on Martin versus Boise, such as Bell versus Boise, seemed to be suggesting that absent legal places for people without homes to sleep, that the city's camping ban could be deemed cruel and unusual punishment and found to be unconstitutional. The city's response was not to attempt to house the homeless. Rather, on a variety of levels, the city attempted to criminalize sleeping via other ordinances and programs. Specifically, the city declared every public space within the city to be a park, including the city hall, larger traffic mediums, and the town clock. Then it closed all parks at night. The park usage times were only enforced on people without homes. An elaborate series of ordinances also allowed city employees to issue stay-away orders to individuals for violating municipal codes, including trespassing, without the accused having recourse to a court of law. The city closed all public bathrooms at night, and many of them during the day, and then ticketed people for urinating in public. The city ordered closed public walkways, fenced off parts of bridges, removed bicycle parking, and other public amendments amenities, to discourage their use by people without homes. All of this was done under the guise of protecting public safety and addressing homelessness. One exception to its success in passing these laws, a public attempt to rid the city of homeless people living in recreational vehicles was denied by the Coastal Commission, wherein commissioners in the majority specifically reprimanded the city for attempting to use parking policy to harass the homeless. It is only with the emerging case law, chiefly represented by the appellate court ruling on Martin versus Boise, that the city has begun to make attempts at providing shelter for its residents without homes. These attempts, due to a variety of factors, including a lack of commitment on the part of the city, have largely been marginal and unsuccessful. Concurrently, the city continues to punish its residents without homes by criminalizing their ability to legally sleep, use the bathroom, and have access to other human necessities via anti-trespassing and other ordinances. Absent ongoing court intervention or supervision, it is likely to assume that the city will continue to criminalize its homeless residents without providing any legal place for them to exercise their human rights, including the right to sleep. By stating, I declare under penalty of perjury under the laws of the state of California that the foregoing is true and correct. Micah Posner. Thank you, Micah. Part of the break at City Council. I'm not sure if this was during the recess. What happened at one point was when the decision came down as the city was about to vote to criminalize the Ross Camp, give it a closing date essentially of April 30th, but run everybody off by the next day, which would have been Wednesday because of the court order by the local judge, Burdick. PRO announcement came in from the federal court saying, hold everything, and at which point the couple of council members, well, Drew Glover made a motion, but it was stopped by Watkins and Justin Cummings, who actually moved the whole conversation back into a closed session beyond public view, which caused Councilmember Glover to protest. He lost a vote on a 3-4 vote with Justin Cummings voting for keeping it behind closed doors. During this time, we had some conversations outside, and here they are.
Currently being interviewed by...
Concern regarding homelessness in Santa Cruz. I've always been sort of focused on the criminalization of homeless people, you know, tickets they get, the less than first class status they have, the most difficulties they have doing the most basic things, not so much because of the lack of services, because of the denial of ordinary services and humanship to them. And there's a whole structure of laws in Santa Cruz, the most famous of which is the sleeping ban, but there are all kinds of other ones, like there's a sitting ban, there's a spare changing ban, there's a you can't sit on a bench for more than an hour regulation, there's a law here at City Hall, you can't be here after 6 o'clock at night. If you're even peacefully protesting, you're sitting on a bench with a sign. So a whole bunch of laws have been designed to either criminalize homeless people, give the police vast powers to do that, or make it difficult for people to engage in peaceful protest about these same issues. That answer your question. Going to move to fire the city manager.
Here in the break,
and we're waiting for the city council to return from its closed session, where a motion to go into closed session, opposed by Drew Glover, supported by everyone else, and actually pushed by Justin Cummings, was.
I think I was wrong when I said before that it was defeated on a 3-4. I think he was the only one who opposed it. Good for him.
Taken in the midst of another motion by Councilmember Glover to allow for voluntary repatriation to the Benchlands campground, and also, but no action on anything until after the court decision. Also considering having the Association of Faith Communities run a reduced campground at Ross, and that was pulled back. We're listening to two non-council members discuss the issue.
Yeah, we are superseding all council members out of dire necessity. We feel that they're, even the best of them, are out of their depth in these matters and proceedings. Some of them are trying.
More interesting would be what you're actually talking about, not the latest improvisation for comic effect.
Yeah, okay.
What were you saying before?
Well, I'm saying Chris Krohn played a good, strong role. He is standing by basic principles and reminding us that the UN Declaration of Human Rights Universal Declaration of should be the basis for all actions by governments and communities. And he's right about that. That's a much better basis from which to act than all these legalisms and mires of morality that they get into here. And you've been here so long, Robert, and seen it over and over. I'm sitting watching the back of your head with your beautiful silver locks, and I'm saying to myself, this poor man, he's seen this over and over, and it's identical every time. There are some slight differences. And I think Drew is trying to lay down a Martin Luther King. He made a big speech today, a major speech, in which he laid out the moral principles of not being cruel to suffering human beings, basically. And it's good that he did that, because it's on the historical record, at least locally.
It's kind of hard to say, to oppose such a set of principles. The real issue is what you do to implement them locally. And that's really the problem with the city council.
Well, that's why this is a good move that the progressives are calling for. This working group or committee, whatever it does, they want it to be democratic and inclusive, so that we help design the program.
Why do we need a fucking working committee? That was done 20 years ago.
No, but this is to design actual programs that would establish camps and shelters.
They continue doing the same thing with this. You're talking about the homelessness committee, right?
I guess that's what it's called.
A bunch of people who get together and jabber for another half year. I'm sorry.
I hope not. I hope it
well,
does.
Were you here in the 2000? I mean, didn't you see that happen?
But I'm not assuming that it will be a repeat.
Why wouldn't you assume that? I mean, you know, because the proposals are already here.
I think now there are enough people of intelligence and purpose and experience who would like to work together to set up a realistic solution or program. That's my hope. I'm only expressing hope.
And that's activist Nutcracker Nick Whitehead. Nick helped to form the Conscience in Action Committee. He actually was the guiding spirit behind it, that has been fighting so far unsuccessfully to reopen the Loudoun Nelson bathrooms, City Hall bathrooms, get the San Lorenzo bathrooms open. They're probably going to be closed again with these Benchland campground, although with it being a fenced-in Salvation Army nanny approach to the whole thing, where people can't come and go freely. At least there's some real question about that, because the way it was to be run, it was described as being, I believe, run in the same way as the 1220 River Street was run, where you were not allowed to leave the River Street campground unless you went on the bus and you came back on the bus, in order not to terrify the neighbors with the sight of you walking by, you know. For a homelessness committee was cooked up by Justin Cummings, which is another bad sign, given Cummings' tendency now to pack with Matthews and be very concerned about some kind of close collaboration with reactionary elements in the county. The idea of having to, again, study proposals that have, when the opportunity to set up shelters is campground shelters I'm thinking of, or to campground, you know, even indoor shelter structures. I'm just not a fan of indoor shelter structures, though some are. These have been endlessly discussed and debated in this last few city councils. Have spent lots of time chattering about housing, but creating very little in terms of real housing available to real poor people. Or that's my understanding. And, of course, rent control, although it was adopted because of fear of a rent control initiative, once that initiative was defeated, the city council retreated to its usual, don't bother us, you know, we're busy, comfortable in our West Side homes or wherever we are. And Justin Cummings turned tail on the proposal as well.
They would have said the same thing 20 years ago and the same thing 40 years ago. Yeah. So what?
Well, you're the cynic. I'm not a cynic.
It's not that I'm a cynic. I was there and I saw it happen,
yeah,
and I'm here observing today the council meeting.
Yeah.
But we have a different perspective.
But I want to raise another important thing. You could probably answer this legal question. Isn't it true the city council just went into
closed session?
I thought there was no real basis for doing that.
I,
I didn't either, and the city, well, let me put it this way. It looked like an attempt to derail Drew Glover's motion that he made right before they did it. And it was done by Justin Cummings. It looks to me like it's just an attempt of, there's some sort of rivalry between the two, because you may remember Cummings was going to, he pressed this motion to close Ross Camp. That was his motion. He and Watkins wanted to close Ross Camp permanently, even though there's inadequate shelter.
Yeah.
We talked to him for 3 hours last night about that in the Saturn Cafe.
Oh, boy.
And his only response was, he was friendly. He said, well, the county is making us do it or they won't give us the money for the 1220 River Street. That's number one. And number two, we're going to hold the staff accountable if they don't have enough beds. And I said, what about the homeless people who scattered all over the streets? Well, we're really hoping that won't happen. Is it Susan? It's the kind of thing Susie O'Hara says, which is, our intention is to do this and this and this. But you see, it's clear that's insincere, because the question that Chris Krohn asked her was, what are your resources? Actually, it was Drew Glover's. What are your resources? How many beds do you have? And eventually she gave that answer, but she didn't point out that those are beds which have to be shared with 1,000 homeless people outside.
Right. She always gives these statistics in a very misleading way, Ms. O'Hara. I've noticed that.
I
don't know if that's intentional. I think it's kind of brushing over the shortage all the time.
Well, I think she wants to, you know, to support the city manager's position.
Oh, yeah.
She is an assistant city manager.
Yeah, none of these people are autonomous. They're all part of a smooth operations machine. Thank you, Robert.
Will you be coming to the Conscious in Action meeting tomorrow at 11?
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you there.
Indeed, Nick did come to the meeting, and he was part of a group that went with Alicia and Phil Posner to make sure that the Salvation Army let her into the Benchlands campground after she had been abruptly rejected, although she ignored the rejection when I was with her. Actually, you'll hear more about that on Sunday. But right now I'm out of time, and I've got other stuff I should be doing. Don't even know if I will, though. Legal papers to pour over for the court hearing tomorrow morning. We will be back in town, those of us who are going to the hearing, and indeed the judge may be back with a ruling, and we'll be at a meeting at 4 o'clock at the Ross Camp. And I encourage all of you listening who are interested in the Ross Camp to come to that meeting, join us, and figure out next steps, because it could be a victory celebration, and that would be great. And if it isn't a victory celebration, it's going to be a need to have documentation of what the police do next as they likely move to disperse Ross Camp people. That's it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Back at you on Sunday at 9:30 if things go that way.
This is Immortal Technique, and you tuned into Freak Radio Santa Cruz. And I just want to give a shout out to everybody out there. And I also want to say that Hamid Karzai, the interim president of Afghanistan, is a fucking CIA agent. You know what I mean? He used to be on the board of directors for Unicol, and now he's Dick Cheney's bitch, running his little operation out there, funneling drugs and heroin. You know what I mean? So keep it real and understand what's going on in the world. Peace.
Dear listeners, all of us here at Free Radio Santa Cruz announce with great sadness that our dear and beloved Uncle Dennis has passed away, surrounded by the love of his family. You may remember him for his truly great show, From the Cream to the Dregs, or for the so much needed echo news about the state of our planet, like Earth First Update. Uncle Dennis was one of the founders of Free Radio Santa Cruz. He dedicated much of his life to its survival, keeping the ship going despite all the difficulties, from the recovery after the 2004 raid and the consequent confiscation of gear, to the frequent site change for transmitter and antenna. We largely owe to Uncle Dennis the nearly uninterrupted broadcast for these couple decades. We all will remember him as a true guide for our collective and a wonderful, generous companion of many adventures. He made many years of Free Radio Santa Cruz possible, and we are so grateful for his dedication and so saddened by his passing. Rest in peace, dear Uncle Dennis, great show host, friend, leader, one amazing pirate of the air.